think we're getting ready to reassemble. While we're doing that, I'd like to give a hand to the Black group for providing us with our snacks today. So three cheers for the Black group. And I would also like to express the thanks of the people who set up that the color groups have been taking the linens home and washing them too. So that has been a very big help. So thanks to the Black group. And next week, our final week will be the pink group. So thank you in advance for that. Okay, I think we're ready.
One thing I promised Judith I would do would be to say a little bit about Michael Morwood, who's coming in May to speak here with us during Dave Rico's May series. How many know who Michael Morwood is? Just a couple. Michael came here he's been here twice with Word and Life. He came and spoke at Word and Life, and then Word and Life co-sponsored a talk that he gave on faith between times. But when he came to Word and Life, I read his book, Tomorrow's Catholic, which has a very evolutionary perspective in it. It was such an easy read and simple to understand how an evolutionary perspective changes our understanding of our faith. And so we brought him here, and it was very popular. Those of you who remember, the thing we always remember is it was in the days of overhead projectors, and he had this pink transparency that he put over the entire globe, you know, to explain how God is omnipresent, you know, and pulling that little transparency, oh, but not here in this corner of the world, or, you know, and it just, wasn't it, Gail? It was just a really impact. But anyhow, he was a Catholic. When he wrote this book, he was a priest. I forget his order, but in Australia. And the book came under scrutiny of then Archbishop Pell, and called him in, and in a very abuse of authority, rude way, put down everything he had in this book and insisted he change things in the book. But this is a man of integrity, and he refused, and he lost his priesthood, which, ironically, when you see what happened then to Cardinal Pell, who then became a cardinal, who has lost his orders. But anyhow, he challenges Catholic thought, even though he, a lot like a lot of us, is happy to have grown up in the Catholic tradition, but just can't hold anymore to some of the ways that doctrines and dogmas are being interpreted in a still very dualistic, patriarchal especially, way. And so he's coming to speak in the afternoon on Thursday, May 14th from 1 to 2:30. So the flyers are on the table over here, I think. So if you want to look at his topic, he's very challenging, and he'll stretch you a lot about some of the ways that, you know, he's going today in his thought. But it's worth hearing him if you can come. And I also wrote a reflection on, since this is Women's Month, and the Women's March was this month, on the original Women's March a couple years ago, I wrote a reflection on the rise of the divine feminine, which is what I saw in that march. And I have copies. If you are interested, you can come up and take a copy for yourself. And I think the main thing, and I think this morning was very scattered, but some of the points that I'm trying to make, especially about gender, I think some of our gender problems today come from a misunderstanding about male and female and masculine and feminine being conflated. And gender isn't whether we're a man or a woman isn't our true identity, is beyond, points to something beyond gender. And that's when I say, you know, but that has become the whole issue. It's more the masculine and feminine in the soul of every person and the way that those energies dance within every person, I think, is, for me, is the important thing. And language like, anytime I've read, I think even in books where the chapter might be the feminine face of God, that's always kind of rubbed me the wrong way. It's like it's the feminine face of the masculine God. But it's the feminine God. Even in Scripture, in the Old Testament, if you read the Book of Wisdom, Sophia is God. She is the one that brought them out of Egypt. She, all the attributes of God in Genesis and the other books in Wisdom, they're all attributed to her. But see, it's because the dualistic consciousness did not know how to bring, to have two gods. They couldn't bring it together. There had to be one God, and that God ended up being masculine. And it's not. God is a dance between masculine and feminine. The feminine in and of itself and all those qualities of the feminine are divine, and they stand for themselves. They are not deficient. And the qualities of the masculine, to me, they're spiritual energies, and they stand on their own. But when you bring them together, then something new is created. That's when the newness, I think, comes in. So it's, and I think the sexual abuse crisis, and I just read this by Ilya Dilio a couple days ago on her blog. As long as this church remains patriarchal, she says in a million years, and then she qualifies, well, maybe a million, you know, maybe before a million, in a million years, this problem will never be solved. As long as the institutional patriarchal church does not recognize its historic fear from the beginning of nature, the feminine, the body, and how all of that has been skewed and misrepresented, until they're able to really face that and reflect on that and be in conversation about that, and raise the level of the feminine to the divine. I'm not for women priests as much as I am for a reformation of the entire understanding of priesthood. But as long as we don't have women priests, and as long as we say that by virtue of the fact that a woman can't be a priest just because she's a woman and does not have the male body, that makes her less fitting to represent the divine. And the Second Vatican Council says that the church is the sacrament of Christ in the world. Well, if half of them can't represent Christ, you know, what does that say? So until they can come to terms with that, and this is why this picture that I like so much of this marriage between, you know, the sun and the moon and the creation, there's the Christ. It's the whole creation. And, you know, we'll never know what the historical Mary was really like, or Joseph, for that matter, or what their relationship was like. This is why I think that Margaret Starbird, who wrote the book The Woman with the Alabaster Jar, that was the inspiration for the Da Vinci Code, was looking for Jesus to have a wife, just because we needed a model of a sexual man and a sexual woman. And I think Cynthia Bourgeau does the best job of that whole conversation in her book, The Meaning of Mary Magdalene. There's no reason why they couldn't have had a relationship, whether they were married or not. You know, what would be the difference whether they were or weren't. But I think what Cynthia is saying is no matter what, they were set like seals on each other's hearts. They were definitely soulmates, okay? And I think Jesus at his baptism understood that the one that he called Father, that heaven and earth came together for him. But I think Mary Magdalene drew out his sexuality. I do, no matter whatever their relationship was. I think they were soulmates. In the same way that Jesus' conversation with the woman at the well, that the church made into a moral conversation about the number of husbands she had, when in fact it was a theological conversation being with that Jesus was holding with a woman, and the seven husbands were the seven gods of the Samaritans, and that's what they were bantering about. But he realized he had met his equal, and then when the disciples brought back food to give him because he was hungry, he wasn't hungry anymore. Why? He just had this nourishing conversation that fed his soul. And so the church always has made these. We have to own that and deconstruct it and then reconstruct it. And so that's some of the point that I was trying to make by my talk today. But I'd like to give you a chance to maybe, did you think about that question I asked? Could you think of a time in your own life where you saw masculine and feminine energies sort of in tension with one another in decision making? Could you turn? No, you can't. Do you want to share on that? You can't. Well, let's share on that for just a minute, or on whatever that brings to mind for you. Maybe with your neighbor or in little groups of three for a few minutes. Can you do that? When was a time when you struggled with acting or waiting? Okay, everyone. I hope you all were able to recall some occasion or the way in which those energies operate inside yourself. One, action and contemplation is another way to talk about it. One other thing about patriarchy that I notice is when we did away with goddesses, that was the beginning of it, of the suppression of the feminine. Thing in Judaism, this where goddess worship was, you know, forbidden. In the Greek world, in the pagan world, there was a spring fertility rite that they called the Hieros Gamos, which meant the sacred marriage, in which the king and the queen would come together in place of the god and goddess, would unite in marriage and consummate it, and the whole thing about the rite that it was about was that their union of this god and goddess was so fertile that it spread out into the land and that the harvest then would be abundant. So you get the idea, if we could have taken the idea from some of these. So that's why to me the Holy Family as a Trinitarian model, the fecundity and the diversity being held right now in creation. We're all family, the holy family. The reading was looking for it. I thought I had it here. The reading on the feast of the holy family about bearing with one another. You know, if we're trying to help heal the world, I think one of the ways, and this is why I liked Rabbi Cohen's Human Family Project so much, is because when he spoke after those murders in Pittsburgh in the synagogue, and he, you know, was just, was hard-pressed to find a hopeful way to move forward, is when the Human Family Project came to him, that if we can promote this idea of the human family and bearing with one another and all of our differences, that might help to heal. So that's why I think the Trinitarian model of family, you know, is a better model than the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Anyhow, would anybody like to make any comments or have any questions? Mary?
So I just want to thank you for using this image of marriage. I've been to a lot of theological, spiritual workshops and talks, but I've never really heard it put together in this way. And it's been just, you know, for the hour, hour and a half, to focus on marriage from, you know, the beginning through as the creative journey that it is and the holy journey that it is, mm-hmm. has been really quite fine. So thank you for putting this together.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. Thank you.
I appreciate very much that you said that we have to find a wholeness in ourselves and this balance of masculine and feminine energies. I think the problem in our society is that we're brought up to be like men or women, like a man's supposed to be macho, you know, and a woman's supposed to be ultra feminine if possible. And we try to match these ideals, and we can't do it. You know, it's impossible. And so once we get married, then there's problems, because sometimes we expect each other to be something they're not, you know. I mean, that's just my thought anyway. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. I think you're right. We weren't given a good model, an equal partnership model for what it means to be married.
I started examining my inner feminine side 20 to 30 years ago, and I sewed clothes for the triplets that I helped take care of, and I've done quilting, and I started making lace, and I'm a blacksmith. I mean, it will sound like two opposite things, but I have said for many years that my creativity is what nourishes my soul. And, you know, we are created in God's image and likeness as co-creators of the universe. I think the Bible, especially the Old Testament, is so macho and paternalistic that it's all, you know, women had no rights. They couldn't own property. They couldn't do anything. Couldn't inherit. Anyway, the idea that woman came from man comes from the Bible. You know, one of Adam's ribs was removed and used to create woman. It's actually the opposite. In fetal development, the male and female fetus are identical. They are undifferentiated. And it's only until the male fetus starts to produce testosterone that changes to look like a male. So that's my thought on woman coming from man. Thanks. I think it's the opposite.
So much conversation like that, I think, is important. This is what I love about Word and Life. You get all these different perspectives and insights that come up. And all of you are so gracious, and you just welcome hearing what somebody else might have to say because of the way it might help you grow. This is really a special gift, I think. And I wonder sometimes if I take it for granted about this community. Nobody's ever arguing with another over a point, and that's wonderful. So, yeah, go ahead, Mary.
I'd like to add my thanks also, Alice, for your presentation. And I just wanted to say that when I was an older teenager, I learned that virgin meant strong woman. And I've never forgotten that.
Great.
It was a footnote in a Bible that I had.
Wow.
Which kind of changes, or at least modifies, a little bit about how we think of a virgin.
Very good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, ever since I read Thomas Merton's Point Vierge, where he says inside every person is a pure place that belongs entirely to God and is inaccessible to the brutalities of the world or our own brutalities, that I consider that to be an out of which God is born in the soul of every person. So in that way, that's how I always began to reinterpret these doctrines. So in my mind, every single person is a perpetual virgin in their soul because they have this pure place that is accessible only to God, and out of which God is born or manifests in every soul. So, yeah, thanks. Tom?
Yeah, I too want to express my appreciation for the dimensions that you brought to our awareness today of the feminine. One kind of response from my end, as a musicologist, I was trained in music theory and such, harmony. And the word Trinity doesn't come into that discussion so much as the word triad. And what is a triad? Well, it's the essential kind of building block for any harmonious musical experience. And you learn when you study music that, you can have solos and duets, but when you have triads, you can have the nuances in there of, for example, major and minor triads, then also diminished and augmented triads. And then there's lots of non-harmonic tones that can be thrown in, and you can make up quite a musical stew if you want to, but it does depend on the presence of at least three.
Three.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, sure.
I think maybe that's what was Cynthia's book on on the power of, what does she call it?
The power of three.
Say again?
The power of three.
The power of three. Well, you know, it's true, even in when my husband and I were married, and I think this is what Cynthia says this, and so does Beatrice Bruteau, it does take a third. We were married, we wanted to have children right away, and it didn't happen. So we were married 7 years before we adopted our first one. But we got tired of living for just each other. Not that we were tired of each other, but we longed to have another. And so this is what they're saying about the power of three. So the power of two coming together, but it's the two loving a third that really completes it. So they both love the same thing another. So it's this whole trinity. Yeah. Thank you, Tom. I'm sure that can be applied in so many different places. That's great. Okay.
I love that you talked about marriage today, because I think that Richard had to include this chapter in this opus that he wrote, but I think that we're already were with him on it. Mm-hmm. So you didn't need to tell us about it again and again. And I think the concept of marriage, as you described it, is spot on. I love it. And but I also want to say that I think it's the perfect incubator. Marriage, it can, no. It can be the perfect incubator for personal and spiritual growth and for living our life's purpose. Mm-hmm. But that does not mean, of course, and you said it a little bit, but it's not meaning to say that marriage is the perfect incubator for everyone. Mm-mm. And, you know, one of the reasons is, as you said, by God's grace, there's always mm-hmm. a third person in the marriage, you know. Mm-hmm. Thank God we invited Jesus in, you know, because mm-hmm. mm-hmm. there are times when mm-hmm. we wouldn't stick in there if it was just the two of us, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's the perfect incubator, but what is the purpose of life? Because it's the perfect incubator for each of us fulfilling our potential and living our purpose. And what is our purpose? And it's to fulfill our potential to grow in union with one another and with creation and with our Creator. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I was talking to a couple that were having troubles recently, you know, marriage-wise, family-wise. And it reminded me of the words to a song by John Lennon, where he says, people asking questions, lost in confusion. Well, I tell them there's no problem, only solutions. Oh. And that's what marriage is so perfect for. Mm-hmm. When you're forced to hang in there, you find the solutions mm-hmm. if you hang in there.
Thank you. That's yeah. beautiful. To me, there's always a third. You're right. When somebody asked me recently in a small group, who gave you your faith? And I thought right away, nobody gave me my faith. My faith is a gift. And if I look back on my life, I would say from as far back as I can remember that I've loved God, whoever that was. That's changed over the years. But I loved God, even though, you know, God was another person. And I always had a great desire for God, to please God. And I do remember many, many years ago feeling that this whole mystical marriage that I felt inside myself, God wanting to marry me, I really felt that. And I said to God, I've been in conversation with God since I was little, bantering back and forth. So I said, well, if you really want to marry me, you should give me some token that would allow me to know, you know, like my husband gave me a ring, you know. So I expected to find a ring in somewhere on the street or something like that. But you know what the token was? My wedding portrait. I lost my wedding portrait. I lost it. We lost it in the fire, the Painted Cave fire. And my husband and I always loved it. And it always hung in our bedroom. And I didn't think that there was another one. And I had forgotten that we gave one to my mother-in-law. She never displayed it, probably because my husband wasn't in it. But I don't know why she never put that out, but she never did, and I didn't remember that she had it. And it was shortly after I had heard this call from God that she came in one day to the house, a year and a half after we lost everything, and she said, I have something for you. And it was I was shocked. I didn't know she had that. And I was so happy to get it. So was my husband. But so, to me, that was the answer. And this is where a spirit and matter are always together. God comes disguised as our life. Yes, I want to marry you, but it will be through your marriage that you will come to understand your marriage to me. Spirit and matter are one. God comes disguised as our life. There's no out there, no one coming to save us. It's going to rise up. So, anyhow, all right. I have a if you want to, just because I think this is funny and very stereotypically male and female, if you want to hear this little story that I always thought was funny that somebody sent me through an email. This is stereotypically male and man and woman. A store that sells new husbands has opened in Manchester, just off Dean's Gate, where a woman may go to choose a husband. Among the instructions at the entrance is a description of how the store operates. You may visit this store only once. There are 6 floors, and the value of the products increase as the shopper ascends the flights. The shopper may choose any item from a particular floor or may choose to go up to the next floor, but you cannot go back down except to exit the building. So a woman goes to the husband's store to find a husband. On the first floor, the sign on the door reads, "These men have jobs." She's intrigued, but continues to the second floor where the sign reads, "These men have jobs and love kids." That's nice, she thinks, but I want more. So she continues upward. The third floor sign reads, "These men have jobs, love kids, and are extremely good looking." Wow, she thinks, but she feels compelled to keep going. She goes to the fourth floor, and the sign reads, "These men have jobs, love kids, are drop-dead good-looking, and help with housework." "Oh, mercy me," she exclaims, "I can hardly stand it." Still, she goes to the fifth floor, and the sign reads, "These men have jobs, love kids, are drop-dead gorgeous, help with housework, and have a strong romantic streak." She is so tempted to stay, but she goes to the sixth floor where the sign reads, "You are visitor 31,456,012 to this floor. There are no men on this floor. This floor exists solely as proof that women are impossible to please. Thank you for shopping at the husband store." Then it said, "Please note, to avoid gender bias charges, the store's owner opened a new wives' store just across the street with the same rules. The first floor has wives that love sex. The second floor has wives that love sex and have money and like beer. The third, fourth, fifth, and sixth floors have never been visited." There you have it. Okay. Thank you, everybody.
What a wonderful ending to a wonderful morning. Thank you so much, Alice. We hope that you will be able to come back next week when the Reverend Tim Burnett of the Way Collective will be here. And he will discuss chapter 17, which is beyond mere theology. So we hope to see you next week.